Before we get going, I have a quick word from our sponsors, the first of which is the School of Continuing Education at Columbia University. If you're spending the summer in New York or think it might be pretty fun to spend the summer in New York, their summer session is excellent. They've got courses in writing, business, computer science, and much more. If you sign up, you get full access to Columbia's beautiful campus and to their state-of-the-art gym, which is probably worth the price of admission alone. The deadline to apply is June 25th, so if you want to check it out, go to longform.org/Columbia. All the information is there. Spend your summer in New York. I recommend it. Okay, I also have a favor to ask of you, the listener. As you may know, this show is supported by our advertisers. We can work with them even better if we know a little bit about you, our awesome listener. So I'm going to ask you to fill out a survey. It's anonymous. It takes less than 5 minutes, and I think you can win some kind of a gift card. But most importantly, you'll be helping support this show. So go to podsurvey.com/longform. It's right there in the show notes. Click through, fill out the survey. Help us, help our advertisers, help you, the listener. It's a giant symbiotic circle of survey fantasticness. All right, here's the show. Hey, welcome to the Longform Podcast. I'm Aaron Lammer. I'm here with Max Linsky and Evan Ratliff. Evan, I understand that your company, The Atavist, will be launching its own podcast soon.
That is correct. That has happened this week, in fact, and you can find it all of your podcast locations, SoundCloud, iTunes, Stitcher.
Yeah.
It's The Atavist Magazine podcast. We're doing serialized versions of Atavist stories. The first one is 1,000 Pounds of Dynamite.
There are one of my five favorite stories you've ever done. Yeah.
Wow.
So
I like this. Go check it out.
I like this idea quite a bit.
There are going to be five total, but there's only one out now, or there's five?
There's one out now. There will be one out every week for the next 5 weeks.
I know how the story ends, and yet I'm going to listen to it.
They're making that story. That story got optioned for a movie, too, right?
That's true. Todd Phillips and Bradley Cooper.
When was the last
time
you guys had a story that didn't get optioned for a movie?
It happens once in a while.
Very rarely.
What about this podcast and this guest?
Before we get to this week's guest, just a quick thank you to the fine people at iTunes.
Mm-hmm.
Featured last week's episode with Cheryl Strayed, right on the front there. Big picture of Cheryl Strayed. It's very kind of them. To any new listeners, hello.
I think it was a well-deserving episode. People loved it.
People love that Cheryl Strayed.
Yeah.
People love that Cheryl Strayed. Me included.
This week, Ashley Vance from Bloomberg Businessweek. He just came out with a book about Elon Musk, which has to be the most aggressively pull-quoted book I've ever seen. People have posted just about every passage of this book on the internet, which is no reason. Look, if you want to get it the efficient way, get the book. It's got a lot of pretty juicy stuff. He's a really interesting guy. He writes a lot about sort of the flip side of the tech industry that is commonly covered, not the apps and the startups, but the manufacturing and the sort of bigger stuff. He's just a fascinating guy.
I love these Aaron Silicon Valley episodes too. It's a good Aaron talking about the technology industry.
It's a great time to hear my unvarnished, uninformed opinions about technology.
They're very good opinions.
What are our sponsors?
Well, say Aaron that you had unvarnished opinions about other things.
All right, here's some opinions. Number one, the best way to get in touch with people is with an email newsletter. Number two, email newsletters can be kind of a pain in the ass to set up and maintain. Number three, there's a simpler way to run one. It's with Tiny Letter. It's from the good people at MailChimp. We thank them for their sponsorship.
Those opinions are coming to you undiluted, unvarnished. Here's Aaron Lammer and Ashley Vance.
Welcome, Ashley Vance. So you have a book coming out. It's about Elon Musk. Tell me the name of the full title.
Yeah, well, it's Elon Musk, SpaceX, Tesla, and the Quest for a Fantastic Future.
Is it weird people sort of disseminating the book without having actually read the book across the internet? I haven't, of all the books of anyone who's ever been on the show, this is the first one where I've seen like listicles with quotes all over the place.
Yeah, I sort of expected that would happen, I guess. And then, in my heart, you sort of want the meteor stuff to come out first before all that happens. But in this case, there were a couple scoopy things in the book, and so we delayed sending it out to a lot of reporters. And then that sort of delayed some of the meteor stuff. It was like a trade-off you had to make. And so I think what basically happened was people got the book this week and then ran through it and grabbed these quotes and charged their way.
It's an interesting time. Like, a lot of people are writing books about things that are done or are known, and then it's the book. And this is a story that's totally in progress right now. So at what point did you decide you were going to write a book about Elon Musk?
Yeah, I mean, it was a hard call on that one. I mean, I live in Silicon Valley and I cover technology, but I was not like an Elon Musk fanboy, and it was sort of the opposite. I would hear about Tesla and pretty much kind of ignore it. It just, yeah. You know, you'd hear Elon talking up things and it seemed like the products were never coming. And so I'd sort of put him into this category of just like a hypester kind of guy. And then in 2012, you know, I was looking for things to write about, and I, you know, SpaceX had just sent a capsule to the space station, and then Tesla came out with the Model S in pretty quick succession. It was about a month, and I was like, man, okay, this guy who's been talking about this stuff for ages is finally delivering, and like in really quick succession, nobody else is doing anything like this. So then I proposed to do a cover story, and he didn't give me a ton of access at first, and then I weaseled my way in into more access and got to spend a lot of time with him. And then I'd been looking for a book, and then when I hung out with him, I'm like, well, this guy actually answers questions. He's way more interesting than I had given him credit for, and I was like, maybe this is my book, you know?
Tell me what you mean by weaseling in. Because, like, there's a tier of Silicon Valley companies that would love to have a reporter, any reporter, even a critical reporter, come profile them. Pretty much every startup wants that kind of press. And then there's this sort of rarefied tier of Google, Tesla, Apple, these companies that don't really need the press anymore, or at least don't need the investigative press anymore. When you go to someone like Musk and you're like, I want to write about you, what does he possibly have to gain from being written about?
He does like the press. I think he would be more inclined than like a Tim Cook or a Larry Page to greenlight something. He and Tesla, you know, doesn't spend any money on advertising, and the other automakers do. So, I mean, he has benefits and he likes it. So
my view of Elon Musk going in, this podcast is going to be rife with my like totally unfounded opinions on tech companies. But my view going in is this is a guy who has kind of a reputation for, God, it's hard to put your finger on this. He's not a villain. I don't think people have thought like Elon Musk is a terrible person, but he's got a kind of a tone deafness to him, to his affect, that I think people have found off-putting. And this is not something like I'm inventing. I remember reading this story very early on about Tesla and a different company that was also developing sort of a car battery technology. And he was like, you know, my thing is so much better. I don't know why people don't realize that. Some people have told me it's because my personality is unpleasant, right? And like, so there's this kind of idea of this guy. It's like, if I don't know if I want to like spend 300 pages with him. Was that on your mind when you decided to do this book?
I think it was definitely on my mind, you know, when I set out to do that first story, and that's totally how I expected him to be. And there are definitely elements of that in there. He is sort of like your engineer, physicist at his core.
Yeah.
It can be awkward to talk to sometimes, and then we'll say things like you were pointing out that just come off, like to him, just very straightforward. It's like, of course, this other company's thing is shit, you know?
Yeah.
And like, this is obvious. And he just will say it, and like to other people, it's like, wow, CEOs don't really talk like that.
Yeah.
You know? But you know, I mean, as I went along in the book, I mean, this dude is complicated, and you know, there were so many different sides to him. I mean, he can be really funny and affable and kind of charming when he loosens up, and you know, he's got the weirdest sort of emotions I've ever run across in a human being. I think he can be really hard on employees and other people in that, like, he doesn't come off as empathetic at all, but he has like empathy for mankind as a whole. It's this very, I mean, I don't think most people are sort of wired this way. So he does feel these like really deep emotions about things, just not about, like, he doesn't give a crap about what happened in your day or anything like that. Yeah.
I think we have this sort of great people model in America where we say, well, this person has had this impact in the world, we should write a book about them. And generally those things overlap with this is a fascinating person. And I wouldn't say after reading the book, he's an unfascinating person. He's not fascinating in the traditional mold. Like, he's not comparable to any other person that I can think of who sort of reached a point at 43 years old where he merits a biography. So I'm interested, like, you've been covering tech and business for 10, 15 years now. That's not uncommon in the world of technology that there isn't like a articulate, charming person to sell it to. So what are your strategies when you're putting together a story like that and you don't have a dynamic, charismatic central figure to build around? Like, how do you tell that person's story and how do you keep it interesting for a reader in that situation?
Yeah, I mean, that is a really tricky thing. I mean, I sort of have this soft spot for engineers and like guys who, I, you know, my favorite stories are the ones where somebody worked on something for like 10 years and finally this thing's working and everybody's forgotten about them and has ignored them, and a lot of times those people are, you know, not the most charismatic when you go interview them.
Right.
So I don't know. I mean, for me though, then I sort of geek out on their whatever they're super into. Then I'm like, let's see how deep this goes. Let's get weird, you know.
Yeah.
And so that's sort of the part that I end up liking.
What's the interviewing process like with someone like that who's not a natural conversationalist or is very sort of tunnel vision focused on their goals? Like, how do you tease out something that a different reporter hasn't already gotten from them?
I mean, so I started out in the trade press, and I used to cover chips, like semiconductors, and servers.
Started off in the potato chip trade rag.
I mean, I used to cover, like, really geeky stuff. And
yeah.
So I think it sort of has helped me a bit. I mean, I had to get geeky enough at that stuff to be able to talk to these people on a level where they would somewhat respect you. And I think that's always helped me, because it helps me build a rapport, because they think, okay, at least you're somewhere in the ballpark of knowing what I'm actually doing. And but, you know, I mean, the one part that's the hardest is like, whether it's Reed Hastings or an engineer working on data center stuff, these guys are just terrible at telling stories, and like, you have to try so many times to pull it out. You know, you're like, tell me what you had for breakfast. You know, they're like, why would I? I'm not going to do that. You know?
Right. So, well, I'm interested. What drew you to the chip trade press in the first place?
I had to get a job, pretty much. I was out of college. You know, it was the dot-com boom. It was like right around 2000. And I'd wanted to live in San Francisco for a summer. So I'd gotten a job at this Information Week magazine.
Yeah.
And I was supposed to like basically be making coffee. I don't think they'd had an intern before, but then the tech market was booming and they couldn't fill their pages. So I ended up just writing story after story. And I'd never really thought about being a reporter. And then I thought, okay, this is pretty fun. And then I graduated from school. And I had to get a job, and that's the only thing I knew how to do. So I ended up going to like their competitor, more or less, IDG. And they had an opening that said, you know, need correspondent to travel the world. And this company, IDG, they publish PC World and Computer World and things like that. But they have this internal newswire. So if Bill Gates was speaking somewhere, instead of sending 400 magazines that they own, they would just send one reporter and then share the story. And so that's basically the part that I worked for. And it seemed like a good gig, and I just got thrown onto chips and nobody else wanted it. So.
So, I mean, in the course of your professional career, technology reporting has gone from like a really like geeky trade thing to sort of like a pop cultural thing. In the days when technology was all geeky, like how did you get up to speed with an engineer for something you were covering? Like, do you read trade manuals? Like,
I don't want to scare you. I mean, I used to go to like semiconductor design conferences and sit in with those guys. I would get like you know, like even past like Linux, I would get like Solaris versions of Unix and run them on my computer and learn all the commands. And
did you have a background in software engineering at all?
No, I was a philosophy major.
Whoa.
And I was like a terrible, I mean, I was pretty much like anti-technology, more or less. I got thrown so far in the deep end that I was like, if I'm going to be any good at this, I have to learn this really quickly. And so I read textbooks.
When you're putting yourself in the shoes of the people who work in this industry, which was a deeply unsexy industry until 5 or 10 years ago, are you also trying to understand the motivations of the guy who's designing this semiconductor chip? I guess I'm asking, when does the human story start pushing its way into these technology stories.
Yeah, I mean, I think when I first started, I would do a little bit of that, but I didn't really know what I was doing. I was just kind of, the thing I loved was like breaking news, and it was like about products. I was like, oh, I just got the thing on the faster chip. And I mean, and then I, you know, from there I went to the Register, this British tech site, and then I went to the New York Times. And I mean, that's when I really started to, like, this, what the editors were asking for, and this switch had kind of flipped in my head, and I was like, oh, okay, this now, I mean, now this is fun, and like, this is a story. And I'd done like a little bit of it at the Register, which is, I think, what the Times kind of noticed.
But
that's when I started to be like, oh, okay, it's not the tech, it's like, let's talk about the motivation, let's talk about the people behind this. And then, I mean, that's sort of what I got a decent reputation for, I think, is that even at the Times, I was covering like enterprise technology, so the data center sort of stuff. You know, I would write about the people behind it and like how things came to be. And I think, I guess I was like decent at that. And so it became fun. Yeah. I remember I did a story on the R programming language, which is...
I'm not even familiar with that.
It's like this open source statistical language that's, it's like... any normal person would not know what it is, but it completely like dominates the field of data analysis and everything. And I pitched it at the Times, and my editor, Damon Darlin, at the time, I mean, he was great. He's like, yeah, go chase this. And then they buried it on like B8 because it wasn't him, but sort of the higher ups were like, nobody's ever going to read this story about R and these two guys from New Zealand. They came up with it. And then, I mean, it was the most read story on the Times for like the entire week.
Really? Hey, I'm going to pause things here for a quick word from our sponsor, QuickBooks. And they are talking about QuickBooks Self-Employed, on which you can save up to 50% on an entire year. This is essential. I've worked for myself. If you've worked for yourself, doing your taxes can be terrifying. You don't really know what's a business expense and what's a personal expense. QuickBooks Self-Employed takes the guesswork out. So you know, hey, I spent this money at the grocery store on some booze for the holiday party, and this money was for my picnic with my personal friends, nothing to do with work. Then when you do your taxes, it'll tell you how much goes to Uncle Sam and how much you keep in your pocket. And I have a feeling it's going to be more in your pocket because it helps you maximize deductions like your home office, mileage on your car. All this stuff contributes to a great tax return. So I want you to go to QuickBooks Self-Employed at TrySelfEmployed, that's all one word, TrySelfEmployed.com/longform. You sign up, you get up to 50% off an entire year, and you help us support Longform. Everyone wins. Thank you, QuickBooks. Our next sponsor is Trunk Club. Everybody has to shop. Shopping can be a hassle. You have to drive somewhere, and then you have to go inside and pick things out and try them on. Then you have to decide which ones to buy, and some of them don't fit great, and you have to go back and return them. It can be terrible. Trunk Club has a better way of doing things. I want you to go to trunkclub.com/longform. That helps support the show. And you will go there and tell them what clothes you like. What's your style? What kind of clothes work for you? They'll assign you a personal stylist. This is a real person who picks out outfits for you. They put them in a trunk. They mail that trunk to your house. You try on all the outfits, pick the ones you like, send the rest back. There's no subscription. There's no ongoing charges. You only pay for the clothes you keep. You can send them all back if you like. But I have a feeling you're going to like them and you're going to want to keep some. And then the next time you need more clothes, they'll know even better what you like. I really like this model. They sent me some stuff. I kept some pants. They look great. I'm wearing them right now. TrunkClub.com/longform. Great clothes. Handpicked for you. Thank you, Trunk Club. Here I am back with Ashley Vance. I was looking at your Wikipedia page, and it said that you used to, while you were at the Register, host a podcast. It appeared to be about semiconductor chips.
I did one about semiconductor chips and then one about, like, the history of computing kind of thing.
So, like, A, who listens to a podcast about semiconductor chips? And how do you make entertainment out of a discussion of semiconductor chips?
Well, that one was surprising. I mean, so... it used to be like 30 or 40,000 people would listen. The Register was like a blog before there were blogs. It was this very cynical, sarcastic, like British tabloid style for tech. And we just totally cornered the market on this kind of thing. And I mean, I would get the best thing about it. I mean, if you were into that kind of thing, it was like I could get anyone on the show that I wanted. And I mean, I used to try. So I had like a partner in crime who was he was very good at humanizing these, like translating geek speak. So he used to help me, and we would sort of tag team on these engineers to get them to lead us somewhere.
And did that make you a powerful figure in the semiconductor industry?
I mean, I guess it's all relative, but yeah, the register, we like broke almost every semiconductor story, and for the size of its audience, I mean, I could email the CEO of Intel or Sun Microsystems or whatever, and they would get right back to you, which was unusual for a publication like that.
From what I can tell, there's only, you know, under 100 journalists who are probably covering this stuff. Are you well known among people in Silicon? I mean, you've been there 10 plus years now in the San Francisco area?
Yeah, that's right.
In Silicon Valley, are journalists even noticed? And is your influence something that helps you? Like, hey, I know this guy, Ashley Vance, I used to listen to his semiconductor podcast in 2004. I should do this story. Or does a certain amount of notoriety start following you after you've been there for a while and you've done stories that may have not brought great things to the people who were the subject of them?
It's tricky. So when I was at the Register, I was like pretty much a ruthless asshole and got blackmailed by blackballed by every company I covered. Yeah. And then I'm probably the only person who will go from the Register to the New York Times, and it flipped because then all these people had to sort of be nice to me.
Yeah.
had been blacklisted.
I had like Nicholas Carlson on the show, and he was like, yeah, it took me like several years after leaving Valley Wag for people not to just say fuck you the minute I tried to inquire from Business Insider. So it's such a small community that it seems like there's a liability for a reporter that, you know, when you look at like political reporting, no one expects political reporters and politicians to be friends. In fact, that would make you suspicious. But in terms of making friends and enemies, like, do you socialize with venture capitalists and founders? Or
yeah, I mean, Silicon Valley is kind of clubby,
yeah,
for sure.
Where do you live now?
I live in Mountain View. I live like a mile from Google.
You're dead center.
I'm in Google town. So, I mean, there's still people I've pissed off that you're just sort of persona non grata forever, I think,
yeah,
on some level. And then there's others that get along with. The clubby nature of it is sort of crappy sometimes. I mean, it's like, I think we have very, very good journalists. I think we could probably be harder on the companies,
yeah,
as a whole. And I think tech companies on the whole are very sensitive and like don't really know how to take it. I mean,
yeah,
it was funny, like, for, you know, when I used to beat the Register, like you could beat Microsoft and Intel over the head and they would never cut you off, and pretty much everyone else would. And it just seemed like these companies were just a little bit older and more experienced, and they're like, it's just another story. You know, Microsoft had been through an antitrust trial or whatever. For a lot of these companies, like Google or Facebook, you know, they just have this glow around them, and then all of a sudden they wake up one day and now people are sort of on them about something, and
yeah,
they don't really know how to handle it.
Well, I think one of the things as a person who reads a lot of the tech press is the technology industry wants to put out these mono narratives. They want to say Uber is great. Uber is solving all our public transportation problems, and the drivers are making more money than they would have cashed. Everyone has won. And then there's this counter story to that, which is Uber's fucking over drivers. It's not insured. It's like basically a backdoor. And it's difficult to tell a narrative that includes both of those things. It's as if the technology industry and its critics can't write a gray story about technology.
Yeah.
You write gray stories about technology. Generally, there's this idea of sort of balance in reporting. And when you're talking about a tech startup, do you approach critics and supporters? How do you keep a balanced story there?
I mean, I try to. You know, I really did used to have a reputation. I feel like I've gotten softer as I've like gone along, and so
yeah,
then I feel, yeah, I feel like I'm always feel guilty, and I have,
yeah,
this voice in the back of my head that's like, if I actually feel like I should be tougher, yeah, than,
yeah,
I am. So yeah, I mean the one nice thing about being in the Valley this long is that usually, and it's not a matter of just like calling the same people. It's just that you do know critical voices who actually know what they're talking about, you know.
Right.
It's like you've built up, you know, who knows, the people who are clever and that you can go to them and get like a real take on what's going on.
In your career, what have you seen change the most?
Well, I'm going to sound so old and cynical. You know, I have a fondness for the companies that used to have big manufacturing plants and make things and employ like tens of thousands of people. And that's kind of where my heart is and my interest is. And so the like current wave of companies and some of the entrepreneurs who run around talking about they're the next big thing and they're disrupting this and that. I mean, it comes off as very shallow to me. And so that part's been a little bit depressing, but then you just don't know if it's because you're just old and cynical and that's what's going on. So I try not to talk about that too much, but you know, it's just so consumery now and entertainment. And I guess that's not my favorite. And so that's been the biggest change is like everything is trying to hit that note. And so I just end up going to find like a gene sequencing machine or
what is it about this the divide? I'm thinking about the opposite of that kind of a business is something like Instagram where you can reach millions of people, but it's a 12-person team and you know in a room basically can create this. It doesn't have that same monumental man against material kind of vibe. Is that harder to write about something like Instagram, these kind of more ephemeral, purely app kind of companies?
Yeah, well, I mean, to just be totally frank, I just don't do it. I mean, I do just kind of like people that solve some big problem that was haunting us for a long time. And that's what just, it's hard. Every time I've gone anywhere, I try to run away from the consumer stuff as much as I can.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
And it, I mean, that must be kind of helpful because I was going to say most people don't want to cover the semiconductors.
No, it's really great. You're like friends with all your colleagues because you're writing about the crap that they don't want to. And then you sort of get like a little niche of your own. And then, you know, then everybody in that niche, if they do have something interesting, they kind of want to tell you about it because you're the only one who cares. So.
Well, you wrote a story in, I think it was 2011, called The Tech Bubble is Different, which I was reading the New York Times review of your book. And there's a quote in it, which is a quote basically someone saying the best minds of my generation are spending their hours trying to get people to click on stuff. Click on ads. And I was like, oh, that was a mistake in the review. That was attributed as something said to you. But that's like a well-known tech industry quote. And then I said it to you and it kind of flashed through my mind. I was like, oh, no, that's actually from an article you wrote 4 years ago. And that article, which really was a sort of a seminal article that I read that pushed my thinking about the technology industry in a different direction, it's a real temperature check on the industry as a whole. It doesn't have a specific focus. It's not a profile of the Facebook ad scheme. It's kind of like, what the hell are we doing here? What inspired you to write that article in the first place?
Yeah, I think I was getting depressed. I mean, you know, I do live in Mountain View. I am sort of in the thick of all this stuff, and I'm right by Google. And it was just getting depressing. I mean, there's so much attention on ad technology. I mean, I essentially, I guess, get paid by ads on some level. So how upset can you be? But it was like all the computer science, all this effort and everything was going towards getting people to click on this little box on a page. You know, I wrote a book previously about like the history of Silicon Valley, and those tens of thousands of engineers before would have been sort of trying to bend new properties out of materials. And so I just gotten a little bit sad. And then when I went to go test this idea, I mean, I found that even people who were like working at Facebook were getting depressed and quitting and at a pretty young age and sort of walking away from millions of dollars. And I thought, okay, it's not just me, you know, it's like people in the thick of it who are upset.
So when you have an idea like that, and you want to write a story about it, is that your methodology to go and find people and share notes and see how they're thinking about it and then make the story about them? Because you can't really, in your position, write a pure opinion piece where you're just like, Silicon Valley sucks now.
Right.
That's not a story. I'm interested in how you take ideas like that and build them something that's not purely Ashley Vance's opinion.
I mean, the way that story and those usually work for me is that I kind of have this idea in the back of my head that I've noticed, and then I'm reporting other stories, and then near the end of an interview or something, I'll just kind of bounce it off a few people a few times and see, like, does this, you know, what's the percentage on how many people like think this? If it's like 1 out of 10, it's kind of like, okay, we're just the grumpy guys in the corner. If it's, you know, going a lot higher than that, then I start to think, okay, there is a story here. And then now I'm going to go like actually hunt this one down.
Right. So how do you not, I mean, how do you avoid becoming the grumpy old man in the room in that situation? You're only a few years older than me, I think. I'm 33. You're not old enough to retire at this point. Is there a expiration date on being a optimistic person in the technology industry?
I think you start to see these cycles go through. And that's the one thing I've noticed this time is that I'll do some interviews with startups and then, especially lately, it's like, oh, I just invented this thing. And I think, oh, you know, this other company invented that 10 years ago. And and now, okay, we're repeating and I've been doing this way too long. And so I guess lately, I mean, the one thing I've tried to do is really push out into new and different areas. There's going to be a story coming up on like a farm that I went to for a couple of years and this really interesting family. I'm doing a story on Larry Ellison that's tied to sports. And so... at least for me, I've been trying to branch out a little bit. And then, you know, like the Elon book kept me really interested for the last couple of years because it was like I had to learn everything about the space industry and the car industry and the solar industry. And so as long as I'm like learning new things, I'm usually pretty happy. And then I've been doing stories on video games and, you know, just all kinds of different things. And then Bloomberg, like I was saying before, I mean, the nice thing is one of my favorite stories is on this video game called Eve, and the company that makes it is based in Iceland, and like I actually got to go to Iceland for like a week and hang out with these people, and I mean, you know, it's like the best job in the world when you get to do stuff like that.
I've asked this of people who cover celebrities generally in music or art. You're put in this sort of artificial situation where you're kind of become friends with subjects, but it's not a real friendship. When you're doing something like going to Iceland to interview the people who make this game you really like, is there a part of you that is just having fun and kind of wants to stay? Or do you ever think, oh, I could work, this could be my job, doing something in technology instead of covering it?
Never quite. The whole reason I like this job is I get to do one thing for a while and then switch to a new subject. And I always think of it as like I'm getting this like mini master's class in something. And I've heard you guys talk to people about that, how artificial that experience is. The one thing I would say is like whenever possible, you know, interview a European or a foreigner because they're so much less uptight than Americans are for the most part on that kind of thing. And, you know, when I was in Reykjavik, I mean, you go out for beers with the guys and you're like really going out for beers and they don't sort of hold back on what they're saying. And I remember I went on a rocket launch to French Guiana with this British guy, and I mean, he let me hang out with him all day. The rocket went missing, the satellite went missing, and it was this crisis, and they didn't kick me out of the room or anything, and I got to see everybody sweat. And then, you know, afterward, when they found it again and they had the party, we were poolside at midnight, and he's doing shots and smoking cigars and all this stuff. And I mean, I was like, wow, you know, I would never usually get away with this kind of thing. And so, and then you get to see like how that guy actually acts with his employees and how they sort of treat him, and you get a much better picture of what's going on.
So when you're trying, in the case of this Musk book, he was not cooperating with the story initially. So you were pursuing the book as a, I'm going to get interviews with lots of other people and right around him. So when you don't have that, I'm having cigars at the poolside thing going on, what's your technique for bringing that together? Who's on that? Who's at the top of that list for Musk? Who are the people who you need to get?
Yeah, that was pretty frightening. So because I had sort of sold the book.
So you sold the book unsure whether he was going to participate
in that? Well, I told Elon I wanted to do a book. And then he's like, oh, I'll sort of think about it, but probably not. And then I wrote the proposal and I sold it. And then I went back to Elon. We had this meeting on a Saturday that I'll never forget. And I'd sort of rolled the dice. And I hadn't lied to anyone at all in New York, but I did have a good rapport with him. And
you had lied about the odds.
Yeah, maybe. Well, I thought it would work out in my favor. You know, I rolled the dice. I mean, we had a good rapport. Yeah. I thought I could genuinely convince him. And so I went in. I had this like hour-long meeting on a Saturday. And then he said, all these people have tried to do this before. It's probably not going to happen. I'm going to write my own book. but I'll think about it. And I thought I had him. And then 2 days later, this email comes in. He's like, sorry, I can't do this for you. I still don't quite know what that meant, but he'd copied his agent. He's like, I think I'm going to do my own book. And
that book sounds horrible.
And my stomach just dropped. You got to do this walk of shame and go call
thing I learned from reading your book, it's that I would not read an autobiography of Elon Musk.
Well, that's what I tried to tell him, too. I was like, Elon, things had just started to turn pretty good for his companies. And I'm like, I don't think you want to do the victory lap. Just people are really liking you right now. And let let a journalist take a crack at this. I mean, the good part about it was it turned me into angry, pissed off reporter mode and like with a super high energy. I mean, I think originally I'd been thinking of, okay, I'm going to do the fly on the wall kind of book, and this is going to be so nice. I'm just going to hang out at Tesla all day, and I'm just going to tell people how this company operates. It's going to be nitty gritty. That's kind of what I wanted to do, and now in retrospect, it seems like too easy and cushy. And so, yeah, I went nasty reporter guy. I trawled through LinkedIn.
You're the only person who's benefiting from LinkedIn.
It's a good reporting tool. I mean, I would just go find all these ex-employees and then send out all these notes. And it was really funny. I mean, when you first start, it's like demoralizing and you get a bunch of no's and you're like, this is impossible. This will never happen.
Yeah.
And then you kind of go along and then finally you get someone who's just this great interview and they know like everything that happened and you can tell, they remember every date and the sequence of things, and then they know the 20 people you should talk to, and then they sort of put in a good word for you.
Some of the stuff is so complicated. I feel like Elon Musk is doing like 9 things per day, even if you're looking, even if you took a 1 month period of the last couple years and you tried to dissect his business history during that time. 3 different companies, 3 different staffs, different cities, different objectives. It's a sort of a testament to human potential in a way, but not necessarily always an inspiring testament to human potential.
I mean, not always. Yeah. I mean, he can scare you and be super intense, but I totally agree with what you're saying. I mean, the one thing was like, okay, this is how far people can go. I mean, it's like, oh, now we know. this is how far on that level you're talking about. I mean, it's good and bad, but it's inspiring. I mean, you're like, okay, then I'm not just going to interview 100 people. I'm going to interview.
Yeah.
I was like, I can do this too.
I mean, did that sort of mania kind of infect you? How did you know where to stop here? I mean, all these companies are reaching their maturation now. Amazing things could happen to this story in the next year.
Yeah, so, I mean, that's a kind of a funny story, too. I mean, when I first pitched the book, it was 2012. Not to sound like the Silicon Valley guy, but all the New York publishers were like, I don't know. I mean, he's probably just going to fail.
And yeah.
People, like, were interested in the book, and there were a few different publishing houses that bid on it, but it was kind of... I had to sell so hard about this guy. They're all like, nobody even knows who he is. And in Silicon Valley, Elon was already like the next Steve Jobs,
right.
But I had to sell this stuff really hard. And then it was like, okay, we're either going to write everything crashes and burns, or we're going to write that we'll see where we are. And then, I mean, this is like probably the luckiest thing that's ever happened to me was that sort of getting it right then. And then I think the Model S ended up doing better than anyone could have ever imagined, and Elon's star sort of rose, and SpaceX didn't have anything blow up, and so it ended up being...
I like the positive outcome is like no one was killed in a rocket crash.
and so on one level, it is too soon to write an Elon Musk book. On the other hand, somebody's going to write an Elon Musk book. I was super interested in all this stuff, and so I just said, screw it, I'm going to do it. And then you just have to... I'd sort of planned, because the Model X, the second car, or the third car, I guess, was supposed to come out in basically like March of this year. And so I'd sort of had in my head, okay, I'll have the book ready by then. And then
he delayed the Model X.
They just laid on the car, so.
Whoops. So most of these people are ex-employees or people who are not active with the companies. Are any of the sources from the book current employees of the companies?
Yeah, I mean, so I'd been going at it for like 18 months, and then Elon called me one day, and he's like, okay, I might cooperate with this, and we had this big meeting, and because there were these key people that I really wanted. At both SpaceX and Tesla, there's kind of a tight-knit group of high-up execs who have been there almost for the entire history of the companies.
Yeah.
And I was getting really worried. I felt like I couldn't really do the book without them. I felt like I could do it without Elon, but I couldn't do it without them, because it was just, you had to know how this stuff worked and how these key things had happened. And so he's like, we're at this dinner table, and he's like, okay. He said, okay, I'm making this big pitch, and he just goes, okay, yes, yes. And then I was like, what do you mean by yes? And then I was like, don't answer that. And I was like, this is what I want. I want this time with you. I want to speak. You have to be pretty, if you're like clear with Elon and very specific, I want to speak to these, you know, 9 or 10 people, name them all.
Yeah.
And I want to go see this, this, and this. And he said, okay. And then he lived up to his word.
So he knew who you were talking to.
At the company. Yeah.
I mean, it was something that was on my mind because the most similar book I've read to this in my limited reading, because I read books that of people who are going to be on this podcast almost exclusively, was Nicholas Carlson wrote this book about Marissa Mayer. And I was like, how do you cultivate these sources within these companies? It seems like this stuff would get you fired. And he was kind of like, yeah, I don't really know. You know, I just email people. And then this week, there's a story, some employee is getting sued for talking to Nicholas Carlson.
Yeah.
So it's not like these things don't have potential consequences. Even when they're sanctioned, someone says something they're not supposed to. Is there like a don't talk about X kind of restriction on those kind of interviews?
Yeah. The blessing of all this was that Elon churns through PR people, and there were so many PR people that were hired and let go during the course of my reporting that I never dealt with them. I only dealt with Elon.
Yeah.
And when I would do these interviews with the executives, I was always just me and them. So I could ask whatever I wanted. Elon tends not to let other executives talk about the companies, and when they do, they often get in trouble for saying the wrong thing. And so they were all, a lot of people were frightened and would just tell me that straight out, that there would be consequences to talking to me, but they still did. And I think one of the things I was happiest about the book is that I got to tell the stories of some of the people who have not been covered almost at all in the mainstream press, and to show, you know, what they've done at these companies.
There's one thing that comes through about the character of this person. It's like a person who cannot tolerate any slight mistake, misstating of fact. And one of the best scenes in the book is that he sort of agrees to do the book if he can footnote the entire thing for you. And you refuse to do that, which I was kind of disappointed because I was like, that sounds totally insane and pretty entertaining. Did he at any point actually give you a response to the book? Like, did he do that not for publication?
Well, we did have sort of a debate when he first proposed that idea, because like, okay, this could go a couple different ways.
Yeah.
It could be kind of awesome because he has a certain flair for his writing style, and just when Elon speaks, it's like only Elon sort of speaks this way, and it would be kind of interesting to see his
Imagined him just shitting on you the entire time.
The thing that I kept seeing in my head was just like, sometimes you'll ask him a simple question and then it's like 20 minutes later, you know what I mean? And
it would have been like a David Foster Wallace
like
level footnote, of footnoting.
The footnotes would have been longer than my book, I'm sure. And the other thing, even that did not totally dissuade me. The one thing was like, this book will never come out because we'll be, you know, he'll never be like, this is, now we're done.
Did you even bring that idea to your publisher?
Yeah, because, well, at first we thought this was going to be a sort of like a deal breaker. And so we had to really gut check and be like, okay, would we do this or would we not do this? Ultimately, I'm like, the cons outweigh the pros and we have to say no. And and he agreed. But that was a pretty, it was an interesting time. So, and then, okay, so then, I mean, I don't want to go like too much like into his personal emails to me, but basically for a couple days.
Please do.
For a couple days. Okay, so the presses had started on the book.
Yeah.
And then I let him read it. I was like, it was physically impossible to make any changes at this point. He was a pretty good sport about it. I actually thought he would still try to sort of ask me to change something. He never did. He did spend 2 days. I mean, the first day I was getting like an email every 15 minutes, starting at like 3 a.m. as he was going through it, telling me bits and pieces that he didn't like or liked. I mean, I was getting emails like subject line, like, this is shit and what the fuck. And
this is why I wanted the footnotes.
Yeah. Yeah. And then it was mostly around like people's opinions on things, which he felt were wrong. And then Then a couple days went by, and then we ended up somewhere in the middle. He's like, okay, this is pretty well done. I thought it was very factually accurate, except for these few things. And we were fine, and then that was it. Then we were just kind of emailing, and then this week when the books come out, I mean, I think it's been a little more close to home, and obviously I think feels like it's something that's like out of his control and everything. And
so what are the email subject lines this week?
It hasn't been that great. Okay.
But you're still talking to each other.
I think.
I mean, okay, so this is kind of interesting. This isn't totally unusual in your reporting. I've been sort of immersed in this Seymour Hersh story this week, and there's this weird thing that happens with the relationship between the U.S. and the Pakistani intelligence service, where the U.S. gives huge aid to the Pakistani intelligence service, but it's also kind of known the Pakistani intelligence service works with al-Qaeda. You are covering these people, and you're in some ways flattering their ego by printing their names in this magazine. You're also a little bit at war with them at the same time. And that's sort of the nature of the relationship that I saw in the book between you and Elon Musk, where he's not outright saying, never fucking call me again, I want nothing to do with you. He's also not saying, I'm going to give you interviews and support this book. It's this weird, we're half at war, we're half friends kind of relationship, which it sounds to me like maybe has like swung less towards the friendly side since the book has come out. How do you navigate that kind of a half friendship with a person?
Well, I would say I feel like I developed a new skill in life these last 2 years. I mean, Elon's the hardest guy I've ever had to deal with. I mean, I would put him in a class by himself, and it was a much longer period of time than even, you know, a feature story. Maybe you're doing something similar for a couple months, but I mean, it was crazy. There were all these ups and downs. I mean, I felt like at any time he could cut off access, and so every time I had an interview set up, and then I came away from it, I had this like immense euphoria, and this adrenaline would just surge through that I'd gotten another one done, and then I would immediately call his assistant and set up the next interview and sort of hope that it would happen. And you know, Elon's so unpredictable. I thought maybe I would do one interview and maybe two or something, and like they just sort of kept going. And you know, he's a hard guy. I mean, we were never friends, and there was I think Elon likes press and the attention. He certainly really didn't care whether I did this book or not, and probably would have preferred that I not do it. And
yeah.
So he was helpful in that he talked to me, but he, you know, wouldn't sort of, I don't think he would like go out of his way for me in a lot of
There's one story in the book that's sort of a clearly left sitting, which is Elon Musk's father. There's something worse than bad, my dad wasn't a great dad going on there. And no one wants to say exactly what it is. You don't have to tell me. I don't know. Maybe you know what it was. It's almost like the beginning of a mystery that just everyone's like, we're not talking about that. We hate him. Like, he's never going to meet his grandkids, period.
It was so frustrating. It was, I must have had like four people start and then stop and break into tears and be like, I'm not going to be the one that tells you. And so you're just like, oh, come on. I mean, what?
Yeah. Okay, so you didn't actually, it's not something
know.
You know
I
that
still
you left.
Don't know. It's like,
I thought that you must have like decided you couldn't put it, that people had told you off the record or something, because it's so, it can't be as bad as it sounds in the book. Maybe it can.
No, I mean, you know, I tried 5 or 6 times with Elon. One time with his brother, I got really close, and then he's like about to tell me, and then he goes, you have to get Elon to approve it first, and then, and you know, Elon has 2 stepsisters who are younger and still live with his dad or live in South Africa, and, you know, it just seemed like nobody wanted to have something come out that would kind of hurt them, and, it was very frustrating. I mean, you're writing this thing and you feel like there's this seminal moment that's like clearly had this enormous effect on this guy, and then couldn't find out exactly what it was. Yeah, it was frustrating.
Are you from South Africa?
I was born in Johannesburg.
Okay,
yeah.
I got that from your Wikipedia page, and I was expecting you to come here with an accent, and then I got thrown off, and I thought maybe it was a bit Wikipedia.
I used to, but unfortunately, it's gone. That would have been good.
Would that help you bond with him?
I mean, I thought, yeah, I rolled in. I'm like, hey, I'm from South Africa, too. He was like, yeah.
It's So you said that you were a philosophy major in college, and it seems like you kind of happened into this career. Did you have ambitions to be a writer from early on?
I always wanted to be a writer, but I thought I would write like the great American novel or something like that.
Like
in high school, I would get pissed off about something and I would write like an essay for the school paper. And I did that like 3 or 4 times, and the same thing happened in college. And I always really enjoyed it. But for some reason, I never thought of being a journalist or doing nonfiction. And then when I went to work at those trade magazines, my very first story was this lame scoop. But I mean, man, that felt good. I was like, okay, this is fun.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think a lot of people, like some of our listeners, you happen to into a job. You're 22. You take the job you can get. And you're kind of way down the road of the job you can get. Do you ever think about taking a sharp turn somewhere else? Or is this something that you're like, I can do this for the rest of my life?
I think you do. I always go through these lulls, ups and downs. Sometimes you'll have a bunch of fun stories in a row and feel really great. And then you'll have a couple, it's just not doing it for you quite as much. And you're like, oh, what am I doing? And especially as like a journalist in Silicon Valley, everyone's getting rich. And
yeah. No, I mean, that must feel
your
weird.
Your opportunities to get rich are kind of limited, you know?
Yeah.
So that's tricky. And then you're like, oh, I know all this stuff about which companies are going to do well. And I know all these people. I mean, I'll have like my inbox will be, you know, out of 6 out of 10 emails will be from billionaires. I'm like, there must be some way for me to, you know, turn this into.
Yeah,
into
seriously, has that like been an issue? Because it's not unusual. There are tech journalists who are becoming tech publicists all over the place now.
I mean, these thoughts like pass through your head. I just love writing and reporting so much. And then I felt like I'd always wanted to do a book. And now that I've done one and now seems to be doing all right, you know, I already have ideas for other ones. And I mean, I love doing the feature stories. And I mean, I don't know what else I would do. I think I would get bored.
When you write at Business Week and in a larger sense, this book, like, do you have an idea of who your audience is? Like, is your audience when you're writing for Business Week within Silicon Valley? Is it people who are curious, people who want to invest in the stock market based on it? Like, there's an idea of analytics and understanding your audience that's very big on the internet that hasn't really come to journalism and the media yet. Do you have an insight into who your readers are?
Yeah, I mean, I think especially at Business Week, I mean, the audience is actually, it feels like nice and collected, although, I mean, I don't try to write just for the business person. I try to write for a broader audience. And I'm always happiest when I take something that's super nerdy and take it to like a broader audience. For the book, I specifically thought of my sister-in-law, she's a doctor. She doesn't care about cars or tech or robots or anything. I'm like, this is who I'm going to write this book for, because I want anyone to be able to pick it up. And then I wanted people, if they did pick it up, to like actually learn something about the space industry or the car. Like, I wanted you to come away from this being like, I don't just know about this guy, I know useful things about the world. And so that's who I had in mind for that one, because I just did not want it to be like a guy's book, because I knew it was going to be cars and spaceships. And
it must have driven Musk crazy to have you like reduce like all of the complexity of the rockets, you know, into like digestible prose here.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like on one hand he was kind of lucky, because I think I'm probably more of a geek than like a lot of people who could have tackled this book and was genuinely interested in that stuff.
Yeah.
And then on the other hand, I could, when I was writing stuff, not just Elon, but I could feel that the guys at the company being like, you know, I mean, this is just like the for dummies rocket engine. And but then, you know, it was so funny. I got this one New York Times review and the guy was dinging me for talking about like the gimbal action on some actuator thing. And I was like, you know, I put that in there on purpose to like show people that it was going down to that level. And you know, so he's like, you just can't win. So
the major thing as like a bystander, I'm from the Bay Area. I grew up in Berkeley, and it seems like there's always been guys making billions of dollars in Silicon Valley. That's a constant. What seems to have happened in the Bay Area over the last few years is that it's taken on all of the dimensions of a get-rich-quick scheme. It's now pulling, it's like a gravitational pull that's pulling every wannabe huckster, everyone who thinks that they could con people into giving them money or any sort of a scam is sort of like it's attracting that kind of personality in addition to the scientists and the people who've always been there. Does that make your job harder with so many people selling bullshit?
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, I think that's true. I think it's gotten easier to... You know, it's easier to start a company. It's cheaper to start a company. It's cheaper, easier, so you get more companies. You have people from all over the country who have come into Silicon Valley. You know, I mean, it started in the dot-com boom. Is pretty bad, but I think it's, like, excessively bad now. It gets harder in the sense that you get brainwashed over time. I mean, you live in the middle of this. These people are always excited. There's an enthusiasm to it. It's like it's not like you want them to do well. It's just like, oh, you know, I appreciate that you're trying to do something, and then and so it can be quite easy to get talked in. This is great, you know, and then you sort of come back and you look at your notes or you try to use a thing, you're like, I mean, it's just nothing.
I mean, I suppose it's also an opportunity in the sense that the story of the gold rush was not the gold mining, it was the eccentric personalities it's all the things that it brought to the region. But I'm interested in like how you hone that bullshit detector. I don't fully have it, especially in the era where things have moved from physical objects where you can say, well, that rocket did not go off. We can all agree on that, to where people are saying, well, we have 50 million users, but no one actually has checked that. How do you report on this flimflam world?
I mean, it's really hard, and I think I am as guilty as anyone of making mistakes, and you sort of, I mean, you're like, okay, if I'm going to do the story, it's not clear how this thing's going to turn out, but it's like, I believe enough in this that, okay, let's spend 4,000 words on this thing. And then 2 years later, it's like, oh, God, you know, this was unfortunate. So, I don't think I have like a magic thing. I mean, it's that filter, and you try to get your percentages up and I don't know, you just got to go with what you're interested in, and then a lot of it's like character, you know. I mean, sometimes sort of like you said, I mean, the products can be secondary to the people, and if it's a person on a quest, I mean, that's what it is. It's a person on a quest, and who is this person? Just being on the quest, if the person's interesting enough, is good. And so sort of what comes at the end doesn't always matter.
Seems like a pretty good place to stop. Thank you very much, Ashley Vance. The book will be out when this comes out. Thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you.
And that was the Long Form Podcast. Thanks very much to Ashley Vance for coming in on a wearyingly long book tour. Thanks for fitting us in your schedule. Thanks to Jenna Weiss-Berman for editing this episode. Thanks to my co-host Max Linsky and Evan Ratliff. If you are like the sound of that Atavist podcast, you can find it on iTunes. I also want to thank iTunes for featuring our Cheryl Strayed episode that was up last week. We appreciate it. We'll be back next week.